You know, I thought about that $87 billion all the time when I was in Iraq, too. 87 billion reasons. That's a good line. And you know, you think that with spending $87 billion, and remember that was on top of what, we spent $60 billion on the war to get to the $87 billion. And you would think that you would see some evidence of it over there, right? I mean, I seriously think that in the minds of many people, they think that this is actually benefiting Iraqis, and they're, you know, in some way receiving part of this money, and I think we kind of know better than that. But I think that there still was in the idea in my mind that you would see building projects. I mean, Kellogg Brown and Root and Bechtel and all the rest of them, right? And so you drive through the cities of the streets of Baghdad, and what you see is rubble and dust and buildings that have, you know, the corners of them, you know, sort of blasted away. You know, a city that's been through a war, and there's no reconstruction. You know, for ordinary Iraqis, they haven't seen hide nor hair of that money. Unemployment in Iraq is 70%, you know, so there are a lot of working families that, you know, there's no unemployment system, no benefits, so there are a lot of families out there that have nothing and who are hungry and dislocated and dispossessed and without housing, homeless people on the streets, all of those things that we know from our own experience what that means. And for Iraqis who are working, the average wage is $60 a month. So maybe if you go to a factory, you meet some people who are making 120, and then maybe the manager or the assistant manager or some technician in there is making 180. But most people are making 60. And by no coincidence, $60 is the same, it was called the emergency payment. That's what Paul Bremer decreed, that the wages in Iraq were going to be when the occupation forces took over. And by no coincidence, that was the wage under Saddam Hussein. So the money wage has been frozen. But when you go to factories, what workers tell you is, we used to have a food subsidy, we used to have a housing subsidy, we used to have bonuses, we used to have profit sharing, and all of that has disappeared. So the actual income of Iraqi workers has gone down, and that's not even counting for what's happened to the exchange value and therefore the price of anything that has to be imported that workers might have to buy. So people's standard of living is dropping like a rock. And so you would think the $87 billion, whoops, that was truly not intentional. But so you would think that some of that $87 billion would be scheduled for a wage raise, maybe, or an unemployment system. And, you know, I was thinking today about the airline bailout after September the 11th, right? And we had friends in Congress, people who were willing to stand up in Congress and say that the airline bailout should have included money for workers, that it should have paid for some unemployment. It should have, you know, that it was wrong to let the airlines walk off with all of that money just themselves. And I think that that was a testament to the fact that as much as we think that we have problems in this country, we are still visible. We are still visible. And there are people that have to take us into account. And when they see something that's that obviously unfair, we can jam ourselves onto the agenda, at least briefly. But you know, there wasn't a single voice in Congress that asked that question about the $87 billion, that asked if any ordinary Iraqi was going to receive any portion of it, that asked if there was going to be an unemployment system to take care of people who are going hungry, or who asked whether or not there was going to be a wage raise or even jobs. So what is the money going to pay for? And this is a serious question because you know, they don't appropriate money like that for nothing. And obviously what it's paying for among other things, is to create a situation in Iraq in which U.S. corporations are willing to go and invest money. Security, a military presence that's enough to create a peaceful enough situation so that investors will plunk down their money and build something or buy something. Pay for a new government, perhaps, right? Somebody that they can hand power over to, who will make sure that the same agenda that the Bush administration is pursuing under a military occupation keeps on going afterwards. That's expensive. You have to buy people. And you know, when we went out to the factories, and Clarence and I visited three factories there, we talked to workers, they talked to us about what they expect to happen to them in that situation. We went to an oil refinery, and in the oil refinery, the workers and the managers both told us that if that refinery were to get privatized and get sold to another corporation, a U.S. or corporation, or one of the Seven Sisters, that half of the people working in the refinery would lose their jobs. And you think about what that means in a situation in which there's 70% unemployment. You know, the manager of the refinery himself said, you know, it would be like condemning these people to death. That's the boss. So you can imagine what workers are worried about themselves as far as what their futures are. And that's not to say that the jobs that they have are really great jobs. You know, it's two shifts, 11 hours in a day, 13 hours at night. You know, no safety shoes, no goggles, no masks. I saw one hard hat in the whole time I was in the refinery. So people don't have the minimal safety equipment, and they complained about getting exposed to chemicals and the health problems that they and their families were suffering from as a result. And so, you know, as you might expect, when the Saddam Hussein regime fell, those workers started to organize. And they had the help of the reborn Iraqi Trade Union Federation, the Workers' Democratic Trade Union, And, you know, one of the things that I learned in Iraq was that the labor movement in Iraq has a long history. It started under the British. They resisted the British and fought them during the 6 years at the end of World War I. And then when the British installed a king, and when we say resist, what that meant was we talked to a man who was a longshoreman in Basra. They organized strikes. The British shot the strikers, and they kept on organizing, and they organized an underground union. Then the British installed a king who ruled in Iraq until 1958, who also made unions and strikes illegal, and so workers organized despite that. So people had a very brave and a very bloody history organizing their unions, and then Saddam Hussein repressed those unions in 1977 and drove them underground. And I think that it's really a testament to that labor movement that as soon as he was gone, they started organizing again. In Basra, they had a strike 2 days after the Saddam Hussein regime fell, a citywide strike. They have a trade union council. They set up a trade union council, the equivalent of our Central Labor Council in Basra, within weeks afterwards. And they had a trade union, they had a meeting in June in which delegates came from all over Iraq, about 400 people, in which they reorganized their federation in 12 industries. They sent organizers out to that refinery, and so as those workers were organizing themselves, organizers showed up from this federation. They helped them hold elections in all of the different departments of the refinery, and they elected a refinery-wide committee, and that's their union in the refinery now. They have one. We visited two other factories, a shoe factory and a vegetable oil factory, in which essentially the same process was taking place, in which workers were organizing themselves with some help, in this case, from another trade union federation. But the thing that was really heartening to me was that under the difficult conditions that you can imagine, workers were not waiting 1 minute before they started organizing themselves for a lot of reasons. And one is obviously the wages and the conditions, but the other one is that they all are looking at privatization and the entrance of U.S. corporations into Iraq as this kind of sword of Damocles hanging over their head. And they understand really well They're not, you know, ignorant people. They've seen what privatization has meant in other countries, what happens when private owners come in and buy those enterprises. And so they want to get organized not just to get a wage raise, but also to fight for the control of their jobs and to control for the control of the institutions that they work for. And so what is it that they are meeting and they are having to deal with in that process? And what they're dealing with is the occupation authority. And the occupation authority has done a number of things. First of all, on the one hand, they've made privatization easier by issuing decrees saying, for instance, that 100% foreign ownership of businesses in Iraq is okay now, which it wasn't before, that you can repatriate the profits if you're a foreign owner and take them out of the country if you own oil wells or a factory or a mine. And they also, well, you'd love this one, they decided that the corporate tax rate in Iraq was going to be 15%. They don't quit. So that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, you know, the occupation authorities are not stupid either. And they know that, you know, the idea of massive layoffs is something that's going to cause a lot of social dislocation and protest and a lot of angry people. And so they found a law passed by Saddam Hussein that they like, which was the one passed in 1987 where Saddam Hussein said anybody working for state enterprise is a civil servant, cannot organize a union, and cannot bargain. And to back it up, Bremer issued in June another regulation which said that it's a sort of, the name of the regulation is called Prohibited Activity, and item B under Prohibited Activity is encouraging anybody to organize any kind of strike or disruption in a factory or other economically important enterprise. And the punishment for it is being arrested by the occupation authority and treated as a prisoner of war. So, you know, you get the idea, right? I mean, these things are related, privatization and the laws against workers. So that's what workers are facing there. And so I think that, you know, to me, this sort of raises some obvious questions. And beyond just the question of are we in favor of labor rights, yes, we're in favor of labor rights. And we see a law like this, you know, we don't have any problem in knowing what it means or that it's wrong or wanting to get out there and campaign against it. But I think that there's some other things that we need to think about as well. Who is going to defeat the occupation? And when I say defeat the occupation, I'm not just talking about the military occupation, but what the Bush administration wants to follow it. Because they want a government in Iraq that is going to do what they want it to do. So in a way, you can consider that an extension of the occupation. Who is going to defeat that? Who is going to fight in Iraq for a government that seeks to preserve for Iraq the property that belongs to the Iraqi people? And what we're given in this country, in the media, and what we see in the newspapers and on TV all the time, is on the one hand, you see the soldiers and you see the occupation forces, and on the other hand, you see the bombings. And the idea that we're getting sold here is that there is no society in Iraq, really. It's just bombers and soldiers. And I think what our obligation is, or what our responsibility and what we need to think about, is that trade unions and Iraqi civil society, that's what's going to defeat the occupation. A political movement among Iraqi people is going to defeat this occupation. And we have a role to play into trying to create the political space for unions to organize and grow. And they cannot grow under this law. You know, if they face a prohibition on bargaining and a law that says that strikes are illegal and are going to be punished by being taken prisoner of war, it makes it obviously really difficult for unions to organize and to grow and become powerful social and political forces. And so that's our role. We can help to do that. We can help them do something about that. We can leave this meeting here this weekend, and we can go and visit Congress people in our districts and ask people who we already know and who are against this war, tell them about this law, tell them about what's happening there, and ask them to hold hearings about it so that we can begin to put political pressure on the Bush administration and on the occupation authority to get rid of these laws so that we get the yoke, at least to a certain extent, off of the back of Iraqi unions so that they can organize and function. But I think that there's a lot that we can do that will help Iraqi workers in that regard. You know, we've already talked a little bit about the fact that they are working in offices that don't have any tables or chairs or phones or fax machines or the basic equipment that we use as union people to organize when we need to do it. So we know what it is that they need from that perspective as well, too. But I think that helping to do this and doing this work is also in our own interest, and a very immediate interest. And what I'm talking about is 2004. You know, Dick Gebhardt, who some of our unions have already endorsed, is touring the country as labor's candidate. That's what he calls himself, the champion of trade unions and trade union rights. And we might be a little cynical about that, but that's what, you know, that's what his spiel is. And I really look forward to the day when I can get into a room with Dick Gebhardt and say, well, Dick, you voted for the war, and there's a law in Iraq that prohibits workers from organizing unions, and it says that they're going to be treated as prisoners of war if they go on strike. What do you think, Dick? But, of course, the real one that we're going out after is Bush. And, you know, I've been remembering Vietnam, too. And the Vietnam War and what happened in Vietnam and the struggle of the Vietnamese people, it played a role in our country. President Johnson didn't run for re-election because of the war. And nobody, I don't think, believes that President Nixon would have ever been forced out of office by Watergate had it not been for the war. So I think that what happens in Iraq and the growth of a political alternative in Iraq that says that Iraq belongs to the Iraqi people and that contests for power in Iraq in order to keep Iraq in the hands of Iraqi people, that's something that's going to have a role in our politics. That's a failure of the Bush administration. A political failure of the Bush administration is good for us. It's something that we can campaign on. And we can get our own members interested and involved in it, even if they're worried about being unpatriotic, and even if they're a little worried about what to do about the war itself, and don't think that they understand quite what is happening with the bombing and the soldiers over there and their own kids. And believe me, we saw those soldiers, and they are kids. They're our kids, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. But our members do understand something. And they understand a law that says you can't organize a union. And they understand a law that says if you go on strike, you get arrested and treated as a prisoner of war. That doesn't take much explanation in our unions. And I think that that gives us an opening. It's a way for us to talk to our members about how we have to campaign against Bush, not just because he's bad about jobs, which he is, but also because of the war and because of the occupation of Iraq and because the violations of labor rights in Iraq is connected to the violations of our labor rights here. You know, I used to think that it was getting to the point where we really couldn't win a major strike against a big U.S. corporation within the confines of the U.S. alone. Caterpillar, that was what I used to think about, right? And I still think that's true. But I think that there's something else now, too. I'm not sure that you can win an election. We can win an election in the United States if we just think about everything happening within the borders of the United States alone. I think what happens outside this country is going to have an enormous impact on whether we're able to win or at least beat Bush in 2004. So, that's it. Just a couple little action items. You know, Clarence and I have been debating about whether it's really possible for people to go back. Because it was scary. I was scared to go. I was waking up at 3 a.m. thinking, how did I ever agree to that? And then I went, I told everybody I could possibly think of that I was going so that I wouldn't be able to back out. And, you know, and I, one of the things obviously that I saw and learned in Iraq was that in spite of the terrific difficulties, life goes on and people live a normal, not a normal life, but people go about working and they do the daily things that people have to do to survive. And that it was possible to talk to people and interact with them on that basis and visit Iraq and do it safely. And so one of the things I want to urge you to do is to go there. You know, we need the people of Iraq to be visible here. And so until we can bring people over, which is another one of those things that we need to do, we need to go there and talk to them and then come back here and make visible the fact that there are unions in Iraq, what's going on with them, what their struggle is about, and what they need. So I think that we're going to try and get together another delegation soon, and I think it would be good if people from 1199 went over and checked out what's happening in Baghdad's municipal hospital that's crumbling under the weight of sanctions and war. I think it would be good for people from Pace to go and check out this refinery and what's happening to the oil workers as they look at privatization looming on the horizon, or longshoremen to go to Umkasar. You know, we know how to do this work. We have done it in other countries, and now it's time for us to do it in Iraq. And the last thing is, I think that we ought to take this resolution and rewrite it and do whatever it is that we need to do with it to make it adaptable and something that works in the unions that we belong to, and then go get it passed and get those delegations going to Congress and collect some money and figure out how you can sign up for this next delegation that's going to go and take that money and those resources and give them to the unions that are developing in Iraq. Thanks.